Welcome to the IAM Radio Network, where noted authority coaches, authors, and speakers collaborate and bring to you the best in radio, TV, and live events worldwide. And now, the IAM Radio Network proudly presents the Dr. Simone Show with your host, Dr. Simone Reves. Get ready to go. Interactive.
Good morning, everybody, or depending upon where you're from, good evening. Welcome to the Dr. Simone Show, the Mind-Body Edge, where we speak of things involving human behavior, mind-body health, life experiences, consciousness, the changeable brain, and how to use these things to achieve business and personal success, freedom, and joy. In my earlier life, I knew what I had wanted to be since the time I was, say, 5 years old. I knew that I wanted to help other people in some kind of helping profession. And I thought, even then, I thought, well, it would be nice to be a psychologist. The reason I knew about psychology was most likely because my parents were anthropologists, and during our numerous dinner time talks about anthropology, psychology also came up quite frequently. Well, I went to Brown University and got my bachelor's in psychology, and that was in lovely Providence, Rhode Island. I should say chilly Providence, Rhode Island. And then I moved to Boston for another 2 years. But after 6 years back east with the cold weather, I couldn't take it anymore. I was a California girl, and I headed back home. When I got back to California, I made a deviation in my plan, and I ended up working in business. I worked as a commercial property manager. And while I was very successful, the profession just wasn't doing it for me. It's just was not something that I loved and was passionate about. But as a confirmed type A and perfectionist, I continued to push and push myself harder and harder in that career until the point where my body completely gave up on me and I wound up in the hospital for several months. When I did get out, my recovery was very slow and painful. And I realized and learned many things. That's when I first started studying the brain and the powers of the brain. And finally, when I was much improved because of a lot of the lessons I learned and the tools that I use in my coaching, I went back and I got my doctorate in psychology and had a really good private practice going in Pacific Palisades. Then I moved to Palm Springs, and I was still studying neuroscience, and I decided this stuff was just too good to keep to myself, and I wanted to be able to spread the information out about the brain and the fact that the brain can change and we have control over how it changes and that it can change our lives. I wanted to get that information out to more people, so I became a coach, a business and life coach, and I've been doing that ever since. I'm really excited today to introduce somebody who talks a lot about the brain and the brain's functions. Her name is Deb Peretz. She is a PhD, and she has spent over 20 years studying how we think and learn. As a former teacher trainer, college professor, and kindergarten through 12th grade teacher, she has come to appreciate the complexity and wonder of the human brain. She integrates the latest brain research into her innovative approach to curriculum, teaching, and learning with a special focus on memory. And I'm sure we're all looking forward to that. If, as we're going through the interview, anybody has any questions that they would like to ask, please call us at 657-383-1534. And now I would like to introduce Deb Peretz. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. As I mentioned earlier, I'm really excited to have you here. As we discussed earlier, we have many things in common that we're very passionate about. And what you're going to be talking about, learning and memory, is so vital and important, I think, for everybody to learn about.
I agree. I have to say, it's also fascinating. We're in a very exciting time right now because latest research is coming up with some pretty amazing things.
Right. Well, let's start at the really basic level. What are we really talking about when we say memory?
That's a great question, because a lot of time we talk about memory as if it's this single thing, and it's not, because we're talking about different types of memory that are stored in different parts of the brain and to some extent distributed throughout our body. In fact, some memories, they're stored as peptide chains throughout the body. So I think when most people talk about memory and learning, they're referring to the kind of memory that relates to facts and concepts. We call that declarative or explicit memory, and that's mainly semantic and episodic. But there's also procedural or implicit memory, which is more the automatic things that we do, like driving, maybe knitting, things that we do without really thinking. And that's mediated by a different part of the brain. These are memories stored in different parts of the brain. And, of course, there's also working memory, long-term memory, short-term memory. So I think that's what's important when we're talking about memory and learning. What type of memory are we talking about?
Wow, it's tough remembering all of those different types of memory. I don't think I can remember all those different types.
The good thing is I don't think that you have to, so long as you learn good care of the memory and how to good habits that improve the memory, regardless of the type you're talking about.
Now, you mentioned explicit memory. If you can, in simple terms, you divided it into semantic and episodic. Could you tell us about what those mean?
Absolutely. Semantic memory is really the facts and concepts that we know. So, for example, the United States has presidential elections every 4 years. There are two parties that we choose from. Those are examples of semantic memory. Episodic memory are based on experiences that happen in sequence in a certain time or place. So, for example, your memory of when you first met your spouse or when you spilled spaghetti sauce all over your boss, those kind of memories that are embedded in a context of experience are episodic memories. And the truth is that even semantic memories begin usually episodic memories because you do learn things within some sort of context. But when it gets abstracted and becomes more of a fact or a concept that we just know, that's when it turns into a semantic memory.
Okay, that's clear. That's great. And then you mentioned procedural, like driving. Now, would that be located then in the unconscious? Because I know things like driving and habits are said to reside in the unconscious.
That's a good question. But as far as the memory systems go, because these procedural memory things we do without really thinking, you could say it's in the subconscious or the unconscious because you don't have to actually focus on them as you do them. So absolutely. But I also think it's good to point out that when you're first learning these things, it starts off as an episodic memory, of course, right? With practice and repetition, it turns into that procedural, or we can call it reflective memory or conditioned memory.
Okay, great. Reflective or conditioned. Great. Which type of memory is most important for learning then?
Well, that is the big question, isn't it, if we're focusing on learning? And, of course, the answer is it depends on what you're studying, right? Mm-hmm. If you're studying driving or playing a musical instrument, you really want to get it into your procedural memory because it needs to be something you can do while you're not thinking about it. But for most parts, when we're talking about learning something new, we are talking about explicit memory.
Okay. Explicit memory, right. That makes sense. Which, let me ask you this question. I've heard about, and I know a great deal about the hippocampus, and most people, I think, overgeneralize a bit and say that's where memory is stored. So can you tell us a little bit about the role of the hippocampus?
Sure. It does play a central role, especially in declarative memory or explicit memory. But you're right. It's by no means the only component. So, for example, semantic memory, that's mainly in the prefrontal cortex, especially the temporal lobe, with some involvement in the hippocampus and the parietal lobe. Now, episodic memory, those experience-based memories, those are more heavily reliant on the hippocampus than semantic memory. Whereas procedural memory, that's mediated by the cerebellum, the older part of our brain. So, yes, the hippocampus is centrally important in memory, but by no means is it the only structure involved in memory.
Right. Well, that's great. That clears that up quite a bit. So how does memory affect learning?
Well, that's how I got into memory in the first place, because as a curriculum and instruction expert, you know, even just starting off as a teacher in K-12 schools, you want your students to remember what you teach, right? And invariably they don't. I've even had students in college one semester, they did fabulous. They got outstanding grades the entire semester, left the semester, and I just felt really good for a job well done. They really learned a lot. And then I'd see them a year later for another course, and I'd refer back to things they learned the previous year, and they'd look at me with these blank stares. And I think most of us can appreciate that, even if you're not teachers, because how often did you take a course going back to your school days and then, you know, after summer vacation or whatever, you don't remember the first thing. So I think the important thing to remember is that it's not so much a memory problem as a retrieval problem. Okay. A lot of times we remember things, we encode them, but we don't encode them in a way that we can get them back or recall them efficiently. Mm-hmm. And that's really the main focus that needs to be for learning. How can we encode memories so that we can retrieve them efficiently?
Okay. How can we encode them? And
yeah, process them, work with them, study them so that we can, when we want them later, over time especially, that they'll still be there for us.
Right.
Sorry, and if I could just add one more thing, if we're talking about how memory affects learning, I think it's important to remember that our memories really aren't all that accurate. They change as we gain more experience, and as these experiences are encoded in the brain, our memories change. So you might remember something really well and remember a few key details wrong.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. And in fact, I've heard that when people recall their memories, that makes their memories change as well. Every time they remember a memory and bring it up.
That's a great point. And again, when we're talking about different types of memories, so the episodic memories, the ones that are anchored in experience, that's where, you know, we can get these details wrong more likely. But when we're talking about the semantic, the concepts, the facts, when it gets to that, every time we recall it, we make it stronger. Even while what you said is absolutely correct, every time you recall a memory, you change a little bit. It's also the number one tool for improving our recall for semantic information.
Right. The repetition.
Yeah. And we'll probably talk a little bit more about that soon. I did have one last thing to say about memory and learning, and that's the idea of pruning. I think we can commonly say it as use it or lose it. Your brain makes new connections when you learn something, but if you don't use what you learn, the brain will see that as, all right, you're not interested in this, this is not valuable, we're going to get rid of those connections and free up resources for other learning. So that's why, let's say you learned biochemistry or something in college. You may have loved it, you may have learned it well, but you never used it when you went into psychology.
Right.
And when you go back and you want to remember some of those basic functions, you find that you don't necessarily remember.
Right, right. You know, talking about, this is a bit of a departure, but talking about memory, and I'm thinking of different things that affect it. When children are, I believe, up to the age of about six or so, their brain waves are operating at a different frequency, and they're primarily in the theta brainwave state. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I find that fascinating, mainly because of my interest in right brain versus left brain and intuitive functions in meditation. So I do find that fascinating. I'm not sure of any links between that and memory per se, except so far as we say that for explicit memory, beta seems like it would be the most reliable mode, because that's when you're most alert, and in order to encode memories, you need that. But I would be very interested in exploring any research if people are looking into the relationships between the different brainwaves and memory.
Well, in fact, they say that in the theta brain wavelength, it's like super memory, because the brain is like a sponge and absorbs everything much more easily and rapidly. And this is the problem with many children, is that they hear negative things that are said about them, or they erroneously conclude that something negative was referring to them, and they immediately take that in, that goes into their unconscious, and they don't yet have the rational filters in their brain to say that's true about me or that's not true about me. So everything just sort of goes into the unconscious and affects them throughout their lives, unless they do something about getting into those unconscious core beliefs and changing them around.
That is an excellent point. And yes, I think that that's a huge issue, because that's where we get those unconscious, subconscious tapes that really affect our mindsets and how we approach life as adults. So I think that's a great point, where because if we're in theta mode, we're accessing different part of our brain and memory. And again, so much of explicit memory, for example, is in the prefrontal cortex, which doesn't actually fully develop until our mid-20s.
20s, right.
So, yeah, so, you know, those young children, they're operating with different structures in the brain and encode things differently, so we don't have as much conscious control.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that what you said is can't be overstated enough as the role of importance.
Great. What about, now this, everybody will want to hear about this one, because I know that billions of dollars of resources are going to, you know, from people's pockets to try and get the answer to this question. How can we improve our memory?
Oh, yes, that is the key question. And there's great news about that, because there's a lot we can do, a lot to improve our memory. It starts with attention, because if we don't pay attention to something first, there's nothing to remember. So the truth is, in many learning situations, it's not a memory or learning problem, it's an attention problem. Just sitting in a lecture hall or attending a conference keynote isn't going to make you learn. You have to actively listen. Same with this show right now. If you're listening to it while you're concentrate on something else, checking emails, doing a project for work, then your attention is already a fraction of what it could be. So the chances of how much you're going to be able to encode efficiently and recall later are lowered significantly. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. that's a big problem we have to grapple with in the 21st century, because we are addicted to our smartphones. Multitask, the myth of multitasking has taken over by storm. And as you know, I say the myth of multitasking because there's, as far as the brain goes, there is no such thing as multitasking.
Right. Thank you for saying this, because I'm tired of saying it.
Yes. It's what we're doing is we're task switching, and to go from task to task, then back to another task, and then back to another task, not only is it more time consuming than just completing one task and going to the next one in sequence, but it uses up more resources. So you feel more tired, and you even feel more stressed, because task switching increases our levels of cortisol, the stress hormone. So, yeah, multitasking is bad for memory because it's bad for attention. We can get better at it. Yes, there are studies showing how people can get better at task switching, which we call multitasking. But that still doesn't mean that however good you get at multitasking, your monotasking will be that much better with reduced stress level hormones.
Right. And I know that increased stress interferes directly with memory.
Another one of my favorite topics. Yes. Yeah. So if you want to know how to improve memory, I could just say relax, but take steps to reduce stress in your life, because as I'm sure you're familiar, we have the amygdala, which is like the little gatekeeper in our brains. When we get, it looks out for anything threatening. And if it gets any information it perceives as possibly threatening, it will divert your brain resources to more survival mode and not necessarily to the prefrontal cortex where it needs to go for good processing and encoding. So if you're stressed out, or if you, let's say, you need to learn something for your job that it involves math and you've never been good at math. There's that other myth, oh, I'm not good at math kind of thing, which a lot of it is more psychological mindset than anything else.
Right.
That stress is already going to, that fear and stress already going to make your learning less efficient, because if you feel threatened by what you're learning, it's not going to the part of your brain it needs to get to. So to improve your memory, meditate or do whatever it is that for you will relax and reduce stress levels, whether it's taking a walk. Aerobic activity is really good for decreasing stress.
Right.
But that's another great technique we have.
Right, right. You know, you were mentioning about memory and mindset. And I can see that having negative thoughts can really interfere with the memory, because the negative thoughts themselves lead to the creation or the development of stress and then more cortisol.
So it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah, yeah. Or the way that we are thinking. Like, and I loved your example about math, because I had math phobia when I was younger, and I really was not great at it. And I think in large part that was it, because I ended up getting my MBA and taking all these finance and econ courses, and I would be the first one to finish all the exams. So once I worked through that fear, I was able to learn.
That's a fabulous example. You worked through the fear, and you came out on the other side of it and was able to successfully learn. And I hope the listeners take that away because just because you have a fear doesn't, or this negative mindset, doesn't mean that's it. You can't learn that. This is something we can work on.
Right, right. Right, but we've got to get out of that negative state. We've got to do things from the more positive state.
Right, and here's something. Since we're talking about just how the brain works, I'm not sure your listeners may be aware, but we are biologically wired to pay attention to threats, anything we perceive as a threat, first. So, in other words, whatever resources we have going on in our brain at any given time, it's constantly on the lookout for threats. And sometimes we get conditioned to see threats where they don't exist. And it happens on a subconscious level so that our body may be going into fright and flight mode,
right.
and the cortisol might be pumping, and we're not even aware we're stressed because
right.
it's happening subconsciously. So talking about, you know, how we get these habits, whether it's the negative messages we absorbed as children that make us associate normal everyday events with threat, or from wherever it comes from, these things are influencing our daily lives, sometimes without realizing it, which is why I really think meditation is such a fabulous learning tool as well as everything else. Because through meditation and things like law of attraction, manifesting, and reprogramming, we can access those negative fears, we can work through them, and clear those blocks, like you mentioned with the math, and then enable effective learning.
Right, right. And then there's some techniques that we can use to improve our memory. And when we were speaking earlier, we were talking about chunking.
Yes. Would you like to try a little experiment?
Okay.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know what I'm in for, but.
All right. Do you have a pencil? Well, actually, you don't want a pencil because you have to remember.
Oh. Okay.
I'm going to give you a sequence of numbers that I want you to remember.
Okay.
But
how long a sequence?
Let's see. Oh, let's say about 15 numbers.
Oh,
digits.
My gosh. Okay.
And I want you, no, actually, all right, why don't we say 10? We're going to make
okay.
it 10.
Okay.
But I'm only going to give you about 15 seconds to remember them.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
Let me set my little timer here so that I'm giving you your full 15 seconds and not making it up as I go along. All right, so here are the digits. You're not allowed to write them down.
Okay.
Well, actually, you can write them down for the 15 seconds, and then you can flip them over. Deal?
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right. 6, 1, 7, 2, 6, 7, 9, 3, 0, 0. And your clock has started.
Okay.
Okay, turn the paper over.
Okay.
What were the digits? What do you remember?
6, 1, 7, 7, 2, 6. Can I say that over?
Sure.
6, 1, 7, 2, 6, 7. Nine, three. Oh, 0, 0.
Fabulous. Now,
did
Yeah. Did you notice how you gave them back to me? What did you do?
In threes. I gave them back to you
yes.
in threes.
Yes.
Except for the
you
last
did that.
Two. Yeah.
Right. Because the last one didn't. You gave the last one as either four or two doubles.
Yeah.
And why did you choose the threes?
That's an example of chunking, but I chose them because it's a smaller unit to remember, and I made a little story about each three numbers.
Wonderful. That's great. I would also add that we're conditioned to think of a series of numbers also like telephone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So this was 10 digits.
Right.
So you gave off the first three right away as if it were an area code, and indeed it's the Boston area code. You spoke about the chilly Northeast.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I am. I'm in the chilly
yeah.
Northeast, although we're having an unusually warm day today. Maybe
right.
it's because of this call with you. And then we're used to having that three-digit prefix.
Right.
And that 267. So all of a sudden, if you know, all right, this area code 617, I lived in Boston, I know 617.
Mm-hmm.
267's easy. And then those last four digits, if I had them, I would look at them and say, oh, 9300.
900, yeah.
Yeah.
But
so that's an example of chunking. Remembering 10 single digits is almost not almost impossible, but it's a very challenging task. But the second you can group them into something that has some meaning for you, you gave a little story about the groups of three. I chose the telephone number. All of a sudden, it instead of becoming 10 digits, it was three groups.
Right. Much easier to remember.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that I thought that was Boston. I still remember that. My God.
That's the other thing. You still remember that. So I would say that for you, dialing 617 became procedural memory for you.
Right.
Because
right.
you did it so, the repetition, you did it so often you weren't even thinking anymore when you lived here. And that procedural memory tends to stick around longer.
Right, right. And that's why, and procedural memory, that's like when we're driving home and we're not even paying attention to how we're driving, but we end up at home anyway.
Yes. So sense okay. of space and location, directions, absolutely.
Okay, great, great. Well, I'm going to prepare us for a little break. We have a brief commercial coming up, and then we'll return and continue.
Okay.
Hello, amazing listeners to the I Am Radio TV Network. We thank you so very much for being here with us today. We wanted to let you know we have an amazing opportunity coming up. We have available broadcast time. If you are a coach, author, speaker, or a business person looking to get your message out to the entire planet, then please get in touch with us as soon as possible, and we will go over the various levels of participation in our network. Again, we thank you for being with us here today on the I Am Radio TV Network. Now, get ready to go. Interactive.
Hi, welcome back to the Dr. Simone Show, The Mind by the Edge. And I'm here with Deb Peretz, who's an expert in memory and learning and the brain. And we're having a great time talking about those subjects right now. I wanted to give you the call-in number in case anybody has any questions. Feel free to call in. It's 657-383-1534, the I Am Radio TV Network. Okay, so Deb, I mentioned that when I was remembering in threes, I was making little stories about the numbers. And can you tell us about how people can use that tactic, making stories to remember things?
Sure. One of the things that we know about memory and retrieval, again, retrieval being the most important part of the components, that's our weakest link right now, is by the more connections you can make with a memory, the more efficient and effective the retrieval process will be. So if I just remember 617 as these individual numbers, that's my only connection. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my only connection to those numbers. But if I think, the Boston area code 617. Then my memories of Boston, my memories of dialing phone numbers, they get associated with this memory, making it stronger.
Right.
One of the things we say in neuroscience is neurons that fire together wire together.
Right.
So when you're thinking of things that's a multimodal experience, it gets encoded together. So if you recall one aspect of that experience, it makes the rest accessible. So if you remember, let's take something else that you may remember. I don't know if you want to share one of your stories. Can you share one of your stories?
Well, I use them more when I'm faced with something that I have to remember.
I can give you an example from the memory palace.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with that. If any of you read Joshua Foer's Moonwalking with Einstein, he talked about
it. Sounds fantastic.
It is a good book. He talks a lot about how to tricks for improving your memory for explicit information, particularly semantic information, but mainly sequences of numbers and things that are especially difficult to remember because they don't have that much context.
Right.
And he uses this technique that comes from the ancient Greco-Roman world. Mm-hmm. And the idea is you use your location. You take a place that you know really well. It could be your home. It could be a building where you work. And you go, you imagine yourself going on a physical journey in that location. Like you walk into your apartment door, you turn left, you see the first sequence of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You move a little further on to where the TV is, and you picture the second number there. And mm-hmm. what you're doing is you're attaching the new information to different objects or aspects of this location that you know. And because it's in sequence of what you'd get to as you were walking around the room, you can remember the sequence of those numbers or whatever
right.
the details were. Some people use that for grocery lists. Now, if you can add emotion to that too,
right.
like imagine you're at a party, it's a birthday party, you're having a great time with your friends, and you take that emotion and then you encode a memory there, then that also will help the retrieval.
Right.
So that's
emotion
one way that the stories
learning.
Help. The more context you can give to it,
mm-hmm.
The easier the retrieval.
Years and years ago, I remember buying a book, the memory book, and I must have been like 10 or 12. And they taught a way of remembering numerically by saying words that would rhyme with one,
mm-hmm.
like fun, two would
yes.
be two, three would be tree, four would be door.
Yes.
I can tell you that and the story making, how much those have helped me get through all of my excessive education.
That's a great example. I'm actually glad you brought it up because the whole, it's also like the audio as well as the visual.
Mm-hmm.
So even, you know, reading things out loud, saying things out loud, turning it into a rhyme or even a song. Now think a bit here.
Mm-hmm.
Most of you listening probably can remember an advertising jingle or song from when you were little, no matter how old you are, right?
Right.
There's something about when it's attached to a song, it's more easily remembered. And so the rhyme is kind of operates on a similar mechanism. So yeah, by attaching those rhymes and music is a super effective way to double up or multiple layer the encoding to make it more easily retrieved.
Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset.
All you have to do is have it your way.
Yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah, perfect.
That's so funny.
Yeah. I remember that two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese,
pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Now, how far back are we going?
I don't even
know. We're going
back
decades.
Oh, yeah.
Decades. And we
yes,
remember
many.
It. Perfectly. And
yes.
yet something from 2 months ago that didn't have that multiple layers to the encoding,
right.
can't
right.
remember.
Right, right. And certainly we say that when something is meaningful to you, it's easier to learn. Now,
yes.
two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, was not particularly meaningful to me. But I remembered it anyway.
And
but
you heard
it
so often.
Yeah. But isn't it true that things that are meaningful to us, we remember better?
Absolutely. And with one exception, something
mm-hmm.
that's particularly painful to us,
oh, okay. yeah.
we don't always choose to retrieve that memory.
Right, right.
But
right.
absolutely, if you can tie in a positive emotion when you're encoding and processing, you are much more likely to be able to access it later.
Right. Now, when you said the negative memories, when we talked earlier, I was talking to you about EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing,
mm-hmm.
and the notion that severe traumas that lead to post-traumatic stress disorder are often not recalled. And the reason behind that is that, well, we could be suppressing them, but that also that they haven't been ever processed properly by the brain.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's such a key component of memory that's coming out of the latest research, is this idea of consolidation and the role that consolidation plays. It's underappreciated, and I think that's one of the things we need to get the word out about. So, in order to properly process and encode a memory so that we can retrieve it over the long haul, memories need to be consolidated. And consolidation takes time. It could take hours, it could take days, and it's usually an unconscious process. Mm-hmm. Much of it occurs during sleep. Whether it's deep sleep, whether it's REM or non-REM, much of the consolidation happens then. And it's especially important for semantic memory. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is when someone has a traumatic accident, what happens is that consolidation process gets interrupted by the accident, and the memories don't get processed. And that's why a lot of these types of traumatic injuries, they permanently lose the memories just up coming up to the accident. And it's not because it was of the negative experience. That's a different type of process of memory interference. But in this case, it's for the simple fact that they weren't properly consolidated.
Right. Right.
And if I can go jump onto there, you know, when we're not talking about accidents, just in our everyday life, how does consolidation play a role? Well, we need to take breaks because taking a break enables consolidation to continue. So taking a break from learning, frequent breaks is really important. And reactivation. So in other words, going back to something after doing something else. So even switching up topics.
Right.
So, you know, that's important for when you're learning. And I think one other thing I would say about that is if you can put your real heavy focus learning time into like 10 to 20 minute chunks of time, mm-hmm. that would also support consolidation.
Okay. 10 to 20 minutes of time. Mm-hmm. Now, nowadays, you know, people are becoming aware of the limitations of the brain, and they're saying that you really shouldn't sit and do a task for more than like 50 minutes mm-hmm. or an hour, unless you get up and take breaks between those time periods. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but I'd even reduce it to 10 to 20 minutes. And it doesn't mean you have to get up and do something completely, you know, aerobic every 10 to 20 minutes. It could be as simple as switching to another topic. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not talking multitasking where you're doing 10 things at once. We're talking a good 10 to 20 minute solid focus on something, and then do another aspect of that task. And then go back to that. So it could be as simple as writing your rough draft for 10 to 20 minutes. Then maybe you want to take a break and do some revising of something else that you wrote for another 10 to 20 minutes. And then you can go back to continuing that draft. So you can continue working, but just by changing topics, you're giving a sort of break. But I would go back to that after 50 minutes, you also want the physical break where you're actually doing something physical as well.
That's get up and move around, do some breathing, deep breathing. And, of course, one of my favorites like yours is doing some meditation. Great place.
Yes. And since you did bring up the idea of moving around, maybe this would be a good time to say that's another thing we can do to improve our memory. Mm-hmm. That's coming out of the latest research is the role that physical activity has in how our brain works.
Right.
So it's surprise, surprise. Physical activity is really important. There are so many studies showing that aerobic activity, the mechanisms aren't entirely understood because there's a lot of research going on now. They're still studying it, but they do believe that it increases the blood flow in the brain. So everything gets more oxygen, and we know that the hippocampus needs oxygen. So in that sense, the exercise helps with that. But I would also say that because aerobic exercise decreases stress, I think that also helps the learning, because you're, you know, cooling the amygdala down and making it less reactive, so that inputs are, you know, being directed to your thinking brain, to the prefrontal cortex, and not to the flight or flight survival brain.
Exactly.
And there have been pretty impressive studies showing that people in high stakes testing situations, those that did a few minutes of aerobic activity beforehand actually had significantly higher scores on their exams, which is pretty amazing if you think about it.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And I know that even something as simple as just taking brisk walks can help. Mm-hmm. There was a study of elderly people, and they divided them into two groups, one which was told who were told to stretch for a year, and the other mm-hmm. who were told to walk, you know, as briskly as they could for a year. And the sides of their hippocampi were compared, and the walking group, their hippocampus had actually grown. Now, that's mm-hmm. significant, because the general tendency as we age is that our hippocampus gets smaller. It shrinks. So the fact that theirs had grown means that they actually added, and they figured out it was, they actually added more than 2 years back to their brain life, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I mean when I talk about how exciting this field of neuroscience and what we're learning these days, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago when people were saying, oh, well, brain cells, you know, they don't regenerate.
They
whatever
die.
You have, that's all you have the rest of your life. It's just downhill from there.
Right,
and what we realize is that's so not true.
No.
So we don't have to fear as we age. We just need to be aware of what we can do. So I think that was a great study. And given that the hippocampus needs oxygen, that brisk walking, you know, fed it the oxygen it needs. So perhaps one of the reasons why the hippocampus has been shrinking is just purely a function of environment, because people haven't been getting the aerobic activity.
Exactly.
But there is something I want to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
So aerobic activity is found to be very beneficial. There's also another type of activity which is very beneficial in a different way. So it's not a substitute. It's another way we can help our memories, and that is with high-intensity workouts.
Right.
I don't know if you're familiar with Tabatas. That's one of my favorites. It's like this mm-hmm. 2 minutes on, 1 minute off, or 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off. Of the high-intensity, it works on different mechanisms that has shown better memory. And in a study that explored had two experimental groups. One did just the aerobic training,
mm-hmm.
and another did just the high intensity training, mm-hmm. and another was the control group. They found different results. They both got good results that both improved memory, but mm-hmm. the different experimental groups improved different aspects of memory. So if you put these two together, you get double the benefit on different parts of memory.
Wow, that's incredible. That's fascinating. See, and this is what I base my talks on, and when I work with clients, is my emphasis on the fact that we're largely in control of our brains. You know, for so long it was thought that the brain directed everything about ourselves and our lives. But our choices really determine how our brains are structured and function, and that then determines how we live and think and feel and act.
Absolutely. That is actually, I think, the bottom line of this entire discussion mm-hmm. is that the choices we make in our day-to-day lives affects the health of our memory and learning and our aging.
Right. Let me ask you, we talked about exercise. What about diet? Can diet affect memory?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked. Diet is crucially important in our memory. And again, this is we're still researching this, so it's not like I can say, you know, with meditation, we've got decades of empirical data that proves beyond the shadow of a doubt that meditation has these amazing health benefits.
Right.
With what I'm about to say now with diet, this is stuff that's, you know, still being researched and undergone, but ongoing research, but the indications are pretty clear that diet plays a key role. So, for example, mm-hmm. with Alzheimer's, many people are now calling Alzheimer's diabetes 3.
Right.
Because, and some are saying it's the final stage of diabetes 2, depending on who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanisms aren't clear yet, but the correlation certainly is. Almost 70% of people with diabetes 2 eventually get Alzheimer's.
Right.
So clearly, chronically high blood sugar does play a role with Alzheimer's. So it makes sense to keep blood sugar levels normal with a healthier diet. But at the same time, the hippocampus needs glucose. So, you know, people are saying, but it needs glucose. But yes, but the average diet, adult diet, is really so pure sugar simple
heavy.
Sugars
yeah.
that,
yeah.
forget it, we've OD'd on to the point where we're not even making use of the glucose we get. So
right.
I think that it's really important not just to have to keep our blood sugar levels, but also the anti-inflammatory diet is closely aligned with high blood sugar and
right.
with disease. So I would say a low-carb, low-sugar diet is definitely a pro-memory, anti-aging diet.
Right, exactly. And stay away from things like saturated fats, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
although I just want to go out and say that we have to be careful with fat, because for so long it's been drilled into our head, fat's bad, fat's bad. The truth is, healthy fats are not only good, they're essential
right.
to our health.
Right.
So I really recommend anyone who's interested in this to look up some of the work of Dr. Mark Hyman and Dr. Kellyanne Petrucci. She's got the bone broth diet. They both go into the science behind how the high sugar diet is affecting our health, how an anti-inflammatory diet can help our health.
Right. Well, because inflammation is involved with so many illnesses and processes
yes.
that go awry in our system. And earlier you had mentioned retrieval as being really critically important, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so that's retrieving the memory.
Yes.
And a lot of students, for example, study and they look at the page and they see a word and they have a little definition that pops out when they see the word, you know, in their heads. They recognize the word and kind of what it means. But then when they're faced with a test page and they see the word in that context, they can't remember what definition was assigned to it. Now, is that because the first, what they were doing was merely recognizing the word and not retrieving it?
Yeah, this is a classic example of something that we didn't get a chance to talk about, so I'm glad you brought it up, and that's interference.
Mm-hmm.
The main cause of forgetting is interference, and that plays a few roles, and I'll get back to the idea of retrieval practice in a second.
Okay.
But one of the main causes, I said, interference is one of the causes of forgetting, and there are lots of different ways this happens. Previous learning can actually cause interference. What do I mean? So, for example, if you're studying a list of words or definitions and you recognize, this is your example, you recognize some of them, you think, oh yeah, I already learned them.
Right.
So you're not giving it the attention it needs. You're
mm-hmm.
not making the effort to encode it with the multiple layers. You're not making the effort to do the retrieval practice. So you're not making the effort to get it effectively into your memory because you believe you've already learned it. But
right.
the truth is, you haven't really already learned it. You're familiar with it. You've seen it before.
Right.
And that's why when it comes test time, you're still familiar with it, but you haven't learned it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example. Or it could be the example of, yes, you did learn it the first time, but you didn't encode it efficiently enough by using retrieval practice. So therefore, you were unable to recall it during test time. And again, maybe you're a nervous test taker and the stress was high and your amygdala was interfering as well. Lots of different reasons can play into this. But so there's two separate things. There's retrieval practice, which helps to encode the memory in a way that you will be able to retrieve it over time. And then there's the interference. So I'll just say a little more about interference, then I'll get back to retrieval practice.
Sure, sure.
So interference, we talked about how previous learning can cause interference, but also interference builds during the day. So what you did in the morning could interfere with what you're doing in the afternoon. If you learn related info, and this is kind of similar to what the example before. So maybe you were studying, you were studying anti-aging and diet, and it talked about the anti-inflammatory diet. And it also mentioned something about exercise, but it didn't really go into it. So now you're studying exercise and anti-aging or memory, and you recalled learning something similar. So you think you learned it. It causes interference.
Okay.
Now, the question is, how do we avoid this interference?
Right.
And here's a fun one. Did you know a nap can help prevent interference?
Oh, I like that one.
And a good night's sleep, of course, is important. But also changing topics, and we spoke about that before with the consolidation. So
right.
Even just switching the topic, you know, work on this one aspect of it. You've got a long to-do list every day. Work on one task for a chunk of time, 10 to 20 minutes, then go to another task for 10 to 20 minutes, and go back. That changing topics reduces interference, and breaks are really important to interference. Get up, do something different, have that break, and not only are you encouraging that consolidation that we spoke about, but you're reducing interference. One that I find interesting with interference is that you remember the first and last thing studied better than the things in the middle.
Right.
So don't always study the same, don't always go in the same order. Mix up the order of what you're trying to remember because it will help. So that's interference. So, but to go back to how do we efficiently encode the memory in the first place, retrieval practice. And that is self-testing is one of the best ways to do it. Not test as in high-stakes test where you get a grade, but test where you ask yourself a question, you write down the answer, and then you check it. Now, here's the key. You have to write down the answer because, again, we have that where we think we know kind of thing. It's like, oh, yeah, I know that. I don't have to answer that.
Right.
By actually writing down what you think the answer is and checking it against the answer key, that's retrieval practice. But if you're not doing the writing down, you're not doing the retrieval practice. So just in short, testing, self-testing, play teacher, argue with a friend, practice in front of a mirror, all that stuff is what really makes for efficient retrieval later on.
Excellent. Excellent. You're really giving our audience some great tips, and I'm sure they can go and use those tips. There was something that had come up, but guess what? I can't remember what it was.
That's because of the interference, because we've been talking about so many related items.
Yeah. Oh, that's not the point that I wanted to bring up. So what are the biggest takeaways about memory that you haven't covered yet? The biggest takeaways about memory from recent brain research, is there anything left to that you can think of, or?
I think we covered most of the really important things that I wanted to talk about. I think we didn't talk about priming. I don't. That's something that many are more familiar with because it's not so recent. But perceptual and conceptual priming, like getting some sort of familiarity with concepts before you get started, is important. But
right.
I would really, the big takeaways I really want to leave your listeners with is that we make choices every day in our lives that affect health and memory. Regular exercise, both aerobic but also intensive, and a healthy anti-inflammatory diet, I think, are key players in memory and learning.
Deb, thank you so much. That was really wonderful.
You're very welcome.
You're a true expert. Can you leave the way that our audience can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking.
Sure.
Visit my website, debperetz.com, DEBPERETZ, don't forget the T before the Z, .com. And I don't know if any of your listeners have a course or are interested in creating a course, but I have a brand new podcast called Teach for Impact. the number one podcast for experts who make a difference while making a living. It's now up on my website and at debpretz.com, and you can see how to subscribe to it.
Great. That sounds fascinating. And if anybody wants to get a hold of me, my website is www.successbraincoach.net. Please note that it's changed from .com to .net. We've been having a lot of problems with my website as of late, so I hope it's working now. All right, thank you all for joining me. In 2 weeks from today, I'm going to have Jill Lublin on, and she's going to discuss publicity and how important that is in getting your message out to more people. Thank you so much for joining us.